So Chua versus Economo. Hope I pronounced that correctly.
Economo.
Okay. So Mr. Reba. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Like Reba McIntyre, you've got that one. You've got that one right, Judge. May it please the court, my name is Stephen Reba, and I represent the appellant, Dr. Noel Chua. This case is on direct review from the Northern District of Georgia's dismissal of Dr. Chua's action under 42 U.S.C. 1985, Georgia's RICO statute and the federal RICO statute. Dr. Chua spent more than 11 years incarcerated before his murder conviction was vacated. During those 11 years, he spent much of his time in Georgia's highest security prisons because he was convicted of murder. Beyond the physical and mental strife associated with his prison service, the defendants in this case took everything that Dr. Chua had through a civil RICO action during the pendency of his murder case, his home, his property, his bank accounts, reducing the more than $2 million the doctor had earned through a successful medical practice to a mere $14,000 they returned via check when his murder.
Let's get to some matters. The Barton Doctrine, it seems to me, does not apply. As I understand what the Barton Doctrine is about, and our case law is not clear about that. In fact, some of our sister circuit's case law is not clear about this. But the concern of the Barton Doctrine is that is one about in rem jurisdiction. That is, where you have a receivership that, and the jurisdiction is in rem, and a claimant has a claim against a receiver, but it's asserted against the receiver for the purposes of obtaining relief against the rest. Against the property that is the subject of that proceeding, of the receivership proceeding. You have to go to the receivership proceeding to seek relief. And that's true, even if it's a state court proceeding, you can't interfere with that in rem jurisdiction in federal court. That's a longstanding principle of federal jurisdiction. And the receivership had ended here. So there's no longer an in rem proceeding to be interfered with. But it seems to me that the problem here is that if what the complainant is complaining about against the a receiver or the receiver's agents are acts taken within the scope of their work for the receivership, that judicial immunity applies instead. And in fact, some of the cases in this area, the Seventh Circuit case Judge Posner wrote, really sounds more like a policy argument about judicial immunity as opposed to the Barton Doctrine. And so my concern is that insofar as this complaint challenges acts that were taken within the context of within the scope of the receivership duties, that it's barred by judicial immunity separate from the Barton Doctrine.
Yes, Judge, and I'll address that. So our argument, of course, is that this occurred while the receivership was pending, but the actions taken by the receivers were so far outside of the realm of the receivership that that would not apply. You have Defendant Lambros, the receiver's law firm, and his partner, Andrew Economou. They're appointed the receiver in 2006. In 2011, during the pendency of the receivership, Mr. Economou also is now serving as a district attorney in the Brunswick.
See, here's the problem. Judicial immunity for receivers would apply even when the receiver's acts were in error, malicious, or were in excess of his or her jurisdiction, right?
Right, but not if they are illegal, right, or criminal. And in fact, just addressing Ms. Defendant Economou's service as both a private attorney and—
But counsel, the district court separated out the allegations you're talking about from the receivership allegations regarding Mr. Economou. Excuse me. I don't think that Mr. Lambros, you've alleged anything outside the receivership, frankly. But with regard to Mr. Economou, you may have alleged things outside, but the district court separated those out and said, at least as to some of it, qualified immunity applies. And as to other things, there is insufficient allegations. So there's multiple levers, multiple layers of why the district court said that you do not have a successful complaint here, right?
Right, but in our complaint, we've alleged that they've gone so far outside of the scope, right? Defendants Lambros and Economou committed fraud and theft in their handling of the assets.
Then your complaint alleges that Lambros acted with the approval of the court that appointed him.
Correct.
Judicial immunity has to apply to that.
But in securing a conviction of Dr. Chua and engaging in these efforts, right, that can't possibly be part of the receivership, right? The act of actually...
Your complaint alleges that it was with the approval of the court.
Well, the approval in the sense that they were appointed receiver, but that doesn't mean it by taking their actions, they're operating within the parameters of that receivership.
Isn't your better argument for judicial immunity that the Starks doctrine applies here?
Yes, Judge. In this case, it's so factually involved. It is so exceptionally factually involved. And what I'm trying to emphasize is that the facts as alleged are accurate. It cannot be dismissed by the appellees as there's some frivolous sort of allegations. We vacated a murder conviction based on what's alleged in this complaint. And we've not even had the opportunity, right? We've not even had the opportunity to engage in discovery. So here we have issues of jurisdiction and immunity so intertwined with the merits of the case, yet we've been thrown out of court for failing to state a claim. Now, I really cannot stress—
How is Mr. Economou not entitled to qualified immunity, at least as to the RICO claims, regarding his actions as a prosecutor?
He's illegally serving as a prosecutor while also serving as a private attorney. It's under Georgia law.
You haven't alleged a complaint based on his illegal service as a prosecutor. You've alleged in the complaint that he was part of a conspiracy to convict your client and steal his money. In other words, you haven't filed a bar complaint here, but that's separate from this.
Correct. We cited the statute 15-18-21 and put it in our complaint, said that his dual participation was clearly in violation. Subsection A of that statute.
Right. But that's besides the point from what your allegations are and what the RICO is. The RICO isn't that you had a prosecutor who had a side job against bar rules or against the statute. Your complaint is that he was part of a conspiracy to convict your client wrongly and to steal all his money and then to cover it up. Right?
Correct, including.
So what actions as a prosecutor were clearly established to have been in violation of the law?
Judge, in this case, in 2012, right, this is years after the trial, I discovered a memorandum in their file that blatantly said, keep blacks off the jury.
Right. Mr. Economou didn't write that memo, wasn't part of the prosecution team. What he did do is litigate the open records thing. And I guess my question to you is, how can it be clearly established that that was wrong when the trial court ruled in his behalf and all the appellate court did was simply say, you need an evidentiary hearing on this? What clearly established law says, and by the way, the open records law recognizes an attorney-client privilege defense and has a good faith defense. How can we say that clearly established law says that this record was an open record under those facts that are all part of your complaint and part of the statute?
Judge, just to point out what happened as in regards to this memorandum, when it was discovered, and this is part and parcel of the environment we're dealing with in this judicial circuit, they, in their answer, accused me of drafting the memorandum and planting it in the file, and then insinuated when I was going to come down there to litigate things that I could potentially get arrested. So throughout this entire process, they attempted to thwart us through not only litigation, which was absurd on its face because they ended up handing over the memorandum.
How is it absurd on its face when the trial court, a different trial court, by the way, not the one that you're alleging, ruled not in your favor and that the appellate court, the best remedy you got was you need an evidentiary hearing on this.
Judge, at the habeas hearing, and this relates to the open records, District Attorney Jackie Johnson appeared, and she, after 3 years, right, of her lawyer stating that it was attorney work product, stated on the record that she had never seen the memorandum, knew nothing about it. The habeas judge, Verda Colvin, was in shock, and that's why she perjured herself like crazy on the stand.
Well, that doesn't mean it's attorney-client. That doesn't mean it's not attorney-client privilege that she herself didn't see it. If one of her attorneys prepared a memo or someone prepared a memo in the course of litigation that she ended up not using and put in the file, that doesn't mean that it's not privileged or work product.
They ended up handing over the memorandum.
I'm not saying they didn't, but how is it clearly established? How
was it stated? It was stated throughout the litigation that it was used, right? And we took depositions of judges. It was used in anticipation of case.
How is it clearly established that Mr. Economou litigating this was in violation of federal law or a constitutional right of your client?
Judge, that particular piece is only one grain of sand in the conspiracy and what they engaged in.
Right, but for Mr. Economou, that was the non-receivership. Everything else goes back to what Chief Judge Pryor said is within the context of the receivership.
So he's acting as a private attorney and the receiver during, at the same time, he's acting as the assistant district attorney in the case, right? Which is in violation of Georgia law. So I guess if, right?
It doesn't create any civil liability though to your client.
Let's say that
he was violating some Georgia statute. That doesn't have anything to do with a civil liability to your client that's clearly established that it would overcome qualified immunity for anything outside the scope of the receivership.
Well, Judge, if it's illegal, right, and he's engaging in that act, then to say it's a part of the receivership would be to say illegality
My question. My question's about the what would have been a clearly established right that was violated with respect to your client. You can't, and you point to like Georgia open records laws and statutes that have nothing to do with any civil liability to your client. What do those things have to do with let's say there are acts that you allege in your complaint that are outside the scope of the receivership and therefore aren't protected by judicial immunity. What is there though for purposes of qualified immunity that creates a clearly established civil liability to your client?
I mean,
don't point me to the Open Records Act because that doesn't do it for you.
But the right to a fair trial, the right to be free from 11 years of incarceration, their continued, I mean, this man's in Georgia's highest security prisons while they're engaging in these illegal actions. So I understand this case on many levels, it has no comparable sort of analog. I've been a part of it for 10 years.
When you start saying things like this has no comparable analog,
that doesn't
help you in a qualified immunity argument.
I think it does because they're so far outside of the scope of what would give them qualified immunity factually, so far outside, it in fact supports our position. And I see my time
is on the lapse. Are there any other questions? Okay, so Mr. Quinn.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Stephen Quinn, representing appellee Steve Berry. And it sounds like the court is primarily interested in immunity issues that actually do not apply to the claims against my client. And I'll let Mr. Rogers address those. But from our perspective, this appeal as to Mr. Berry is frivolous and Mr. Berry should not have had to participate. The only allegation in the complaint against Mr. Berry is that he wrote a memorandum that was basically giving advice on jury selection to the district attorney coming in from another county. And the key allegation against Mr. Berry is that he was part of a conspiracy, but that paragraph of the complaint says that upon information and belief, Mr. Berry joined a conspiracy. That is far short of the pleading standards for conspiracy claims like RICO.
Here's my concern, though. Even if it were true that the conspirators tried to keep Black jurors off the panel in the hopes of keeping of increasing the chances of obtaining Chua's conviction, that allegation does not mean that the conspiracy was motivated by racial or otherwise class-based invidiously discriminatory animus against Mr. Chua, which right. is what has to be done for purposes of Section 1985. Isn't that right?
I completely agree, Your Honor. And that was the grounds upon which the district court dismissed the claims under 1985, under the United Brothers and Carpenters case. That's a required element of any such claim. And not only was it not alleged in the complaint, but as to Mr. Berry, the complaint actually included an allegation to the contrary, which was that Mr. Berry was motivated by a personal animus against Sheriff Bill right. Smith.
Right.
And so the complaint is self-defeating on that claim. You know, the only that was one of the items appealed as far as Mr. Berry is concerned, the 1985. And the other was the appellant has contended that the district court should have given leave to add a Section 1983 count that was not included.
Well, he admits that the district court didn't abuse its discretion, but just but says
right.
that just as a matter of fairness, it ought to be allowed.
That's right, Your Honor. On page 50, it basically admits that discretion was not abused. There's 11th Circuit case law.
I don't know how we can reverse the district court when there's an admission the district court didn't abuse its discretion.
I couldn't agree more, Your Honor. Unless the panel has questions for me, I'm prepared to yield my time to Mr. Rogers.
Okay, Mr. Rogers.
Thank you, and may it please the court, John Rogers from Michael Lambros and Andrew Economou. The major point I want to make this morning is that there are multiple independent grounds on which this court can affirm the judgment. The
you
court
understand. Is I- not... You understand my point about the Barton Doctrine, but the judicial immunity is the far more serious issue?
Yes, sir, I do. And the court does not have to decide the Barton issue if it doesn't want to.
Well, as counsel, discuss to me how Sparks, so I want to go to judicial immunity, discuss to me how Sparks, which opposing counsel does argue in his brief, does not apply here, where the judge is alleged to have been, the judge who blessed everything that happened is alleged to be in on a conspiracy and part of the corruption.
There are two problems with the Sparks argument. One is they haven't pled the conspiracy with any sufficiency. Two, in Sparks, the people who were denied immunity were private actors. In this case, Michael Lambros was a receiver. He's a public actor. He stands in the shoes or in the robe of judge for Sparks purposes. And so Michael Lambros still enjoys that judicial immunity. Sparks did not say that other public officials lose judicial immunity if they conspire. Sparks simply says that private actors cannot claim immunity if they conspire with the judge. And immunity, I think, is the simplest alternative ground on which this court can affirm.
I think we have to address the Barton Doctrine because the problem is that that's a determination of a lack of subject matter jurisdiction. And if it were to apply, we'd have to affirm the dismissal based on lack of subject matter jurisdiction. But if it doesn't apply, and judicial immunity is the doctrine, then it's a merits-based defense. So I think we have to say something about the Barton Doctrine.
Judge, I'll say something about the Barton Doctrine, if I may. I think the Barton Doctrine, there is an argument that the Barton Doctrine still governs here because you've got an additional concern here that's not present in the typical Barton case. And that's the
federal. Have you read our recent decision in Tufts?
Yes, sir. Tufts is distinguishable because in Tufts, there was a discussion of the tactical jurisdiction of the bankruptcy court.
Yeah. No, but aren't they both based on in rem jurisdiction? And once the receivership is over, that's no longer a concern, and it just as it is in bankruptcy, which is what Tufts said.
Judge, that's one of the concerns, but it's not the only concern. Some of the other concerns mentioned in even in the Tufts opinion itself include the burden that lawsuits place on trustees and receivers, the difficulty.
To me goes to judicial immunity.
I agree, Judge.
I think there's confusion in the case law about this. And you know, those kinds of concerns about being free from litigation for the acts that you're taking as a trustee or as a receiver, those are immunity concerns. Those are not Barton Doctrine concerns.
They are concerns mentioned in the Barton cases. But
Barton cases, but not Barton. If you go back and read it, which
it's actually mentioned in Tufts. I think it was mentioned in one of this court's earlier opinions from the 80s that we cited in the brief. But I want to make sure that I have a chance to talk about what Judge Luck called the multiple levels of problems.
Well, counsel, if I could get there, so. I want to ask a pretty fundamental question, and that seems to be a matter of confusion for everybody. And that is that, as I understand our case law, we are quite clear that qualified immunity does not apply to 1985 actions, to conspiracy actions. We've said it time and time again. And yet nobody brings that up from the district court all the way to now. So even if I agreed with you that qualified immunity applied for the RICO allegations, how can we say that qualified immunity applies for the civil conspiracy under 1985?
Judge, I'd refer you to the Supreme Court's opinion in Ziegler versus Abbasi, which is 137 Supreme Court 1843 from the year 2017. And there the Supreme Court discussed, and I believe I'm correct to say that it applied qualified immunity to claims under 1985-3. And I
will take a look at it, but we have case law as recently as 2010 or
anything
more case law throughout it being quite clear that public officials will not be subject to liability under that public officials cannot raise a qualified immunity defense to a section 1983 subsection 3 claim. And I hope the case you're citing to me is a subsection 3 claim, which is what we're talking about here. Because we've been specific about that.
Your Honor, I must confess, this is something I looked at just at the last minute, and I really don't profess any expertise because it was not briefed below or up here. But I would refer the court to that.
I mean, we can't make a mistake of law. We can't apply it if it's wrong, if it cannot be applied, if it cannot be asserted.
Well, I think the court can still find the waiver because there was no conspiracy. There was no argument below that you cannot give qualified immunity to claims of conspiracy under 1985-3. So the court could find the way. But even if we assume.
Let me ask you this. What are the allegations for 1985 against your client?
Well, there really aren't any, and that's yet another ground on which the court can affirm that there's no allegation in the pleadings that Andrew.
Well, it's part of them. It's the memo conspiracy. It's your client was part of the one who, again, this is alleged. I'm not saying it happened. Your client was part of the conspiracy to hide this document and hide the fact that they had during jury selection violated Batson, right?
There's no allegation that we had anything to do with the memo, the trial, either one.
Well, no, but I meant hiding it when it was discovered so that, you know, once it's discovered, there's the open records litigation where your client was involved in making sure it didn't come to light today, and then the habeas litigation to make sure that it wasn't used. That's the allegation. But I guess my question is, if the trial court ruled, as Judge Pryor discussed, that memo can't be a basis for a 1985 action because there's no animus against the plaintiff here, which is what must be shown, then wouldn't that be as true for your client as it would be for Mr. Berry?
Yes, absolutely.
So is that not the basis by which we could affirm 1985 subsection 3 claim against your client, irrespective of whether there's qualified immunity for that or not?
Yes, absolutely. And
I guess my concern was, the way I read this, this is a somewhat confusing case, was that the only arguments really that are made against your client about what rights he allegedly violated all pertain to how he conducted the open records litigation, and none of which, as far as I could tell, involved any laws that create civil liability to the plaintiff.
Judge, I think that's correct. Just to be clear, the open records allegations are made against Andrew Economou. In fairness, there are different allegations made against the receiver, Michael Lambros.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. We're talking about Mr. Economou, sorry.
Yes, sir. That's correct. Just very briefly, another one of those multiple levels.
Well, it seems to me, I mean, the problem with Lambros is everything that Lambros does is protected by judicial immunity.
That's what we contend, Judge, yes. And I'll also just briefly mention the statute of limitations. The pleadings allege that as early as 2007, Michael Lambros was filing reports that were false on their face. And that by 2010, he was filing a report that showed, again, on its face, embezzlement, dishonesty.
But counsel, as I understand the statute of limitations regarding RICO, which is where we're coming up, at least with regard to RICO, that it's the last predicate act that causes a harm that the statute of limitations needs to be triggered towards. And here, there's at least an allegation regarding the plea agreement that was entered into, and there's allegations regarding the illegality of that plea agreement in 2017, which would be within the 14 year or the 4 years and 5 years under the Georgia and federal RICO statutes, right?
Judge, we argue that it's not the last predicate act. It's inquiry notice under federal and state law.
Right, except where the predicate act creates an independent harm for which then it goes to. And that, I mean, there's tons of cases for that proposition, but you can look to Lehman versus Lukman, that if a new RICO predicate act gives rise to a new and independent injury, the statute of limitations clock will start over for the damages caused by that new act.
We would contend that it's all part of the same conspiracy.
How is it not an individual? How is the plea agreement not an individual harm? That's independent of the money that was taken, that's independent of anything else. Again, assuming it is a double jeopardy violation, which is what the allegation is.
And Your Honor, I'm out of time. May I go ahead and answer?
Yeah, of course.
The pleadings allege that the plea agreement was all part and parcel of the same conspiracy. And if the theory is that they all conspired, then they had inquiry notice of the conspiracy as early as 2007.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Reba, you have 3 minutes.
Yes, Judge. Regarding that plea agreement, where Dr. Chua pled guilty to the dwelling house count, which had been invalidated on direct appeal, this was done purely to try to secure the forfeiture. And on that point, and this goes to, I know we're talking as if Barton doesn't apply, and that's accurate. But it goes to just everything involved with this case. He was also banished a part of that plea agreement, could not come back to that circuit or the Waycross.
Can you speak to the Heck versus Humphrey issue? What does this do to the underlying criminal conviction that he has pled guilty to in the plea agreement?
What does this action do to that?
Would it undermine his criminal conviction?
I don't believe it would, Your Honor. And to be honest, that's what we have been so incredibly cognizant of throughout this entire process. We were scared to come back and ask the court for leave. We were scared to step foot in that place because the way that things had been conducted, right? This is a jurisdiction where they left a memo like that just sitting around. No one thought to destroy it, just par for the course, right? Impunity. You know, this is a terrifying place for him. I was threatened with arrest effectively in the answer. So this is all done through coercion. And the fact that we have to plead to an invalidated count to try to secure the forfeiture is telling. And this case is so, the merits with the issues of immunity are so intertwined. It is really an injustice that we cannot engage in discovery when these same facts invalidated a conviction handed down by a jury, right? So everyone involved with this thought it was egregious enough.
Am I right though? Which was then followed by a different conviction?
We pled guilty to involuntary manslaughter and he walked out of the prison.
Yeah, for time served, right.
Time served.
It's not that he no longer has a conviction, he does.
That's correct, Judge, but that's because he's you know, a diminutive.
You can say whatever you want, that's because he has a conviction, right?
Yeah, absolutely. He's convicted of involuntary manslaughter and keeping a dwelling place, which was invalidated on direct appeal in 2011. But the point, my overarching point remains, these things were simply just done to get him out of prison. Obviously, life is finite. Life is extraordinarily finite in prison, so that there's no guarantee you're living next week. So, you know, all we are saying is give us, there's viability to these issues. They're intertwined issues of immunity, issues of the merits. And this court has held that when that's the case, it's not appropriate to dismiss a case as this one was dismissed. And I see my time has elapsed.
Thank you, Mr. Reba. We have your case, and we will now move to the last one for today.